Well, could you describe a little more in detail that 4th of July celebration of the so-called block party?
Well, somebody on the main block, the 1300 block of Sheridan Avenue, around the 1st of June, would take responsibility to remind us all that the 4th of July was coming, and that we had a system where the people on the even side of the street brought dessert, and the people on the odd side brought salads, and then each family brought their own main course, and they would set up and you were to bring enough of either dessert or salad, I think for 8 people, something like that, you know, and especially if, and we could all invite guests, which we always did too. They would set up the day began somebody took responsibility for organizing the thing, you know, and there was a keg of beer that was ordered, and they got a crate of corn, or a bushel or a whatever, and somebody was responsible for shucking and cooking the corn. And it got a little more elaborate with the passing years. They had some people didn't want to bother cooking, so they had hot dogs and that you could buy, but you had to reserve them. If that's what you wanted, you ordered your hot dogs or your meatball sandwiches or whatever that was on the menu. But mostly we cooked our own. And the day started in the morning with a parade for the children. They got all dressed up. They had a bicycle parade with bicycles decorated. And there were games for the kids. And then the beer, I think the corn, usually it seems to me it was early afternoon when they started on the corn, which I never could figure out why they did that. But that became traditional. Then there were games. Oh, there was volleyball. They set up a volleyball net. After dinner, there was square dancing or something of that nature. There was a pinata for the little kids after supper, and that was always one of the highlights of the evening. And they divided the children into two age groups so that. Because of course the little ones wouldn't they had their own pinata, and it went on, you know, into the evening. There always was a rain date, and invariably there was we got at least a drizzle, but mostly we were pretty lucky. I don't recall many of them that had to be canceled. And we really looked forward to that. And we have been back now, both July, since we are away. They notify us, and we do go back. And it was, the neighborhood was, as I say, there was such a cross section. A lot of university people, every ethnic color, religious representation that you could think of. And really, everyone got along very well. There was a good neighborhood feeling, and there was, I don't think we had a formalized neighborhood watch or anything, but people were very aware of, you know, any suspicious characters, and there was a real sense of community in both those little areas where we lived. They were several blocks apart and quite, you know, none of the same people really, but the same kind of same feeling there. I think nothing that I ever experienced in Cleveland that I can remember, but that it's not fair to compare, because I, after all, I had lived all my life in Cleveland, and I had a broad circle of friends, so I didn't need that, and I lived in an area where so many of my friends happened to live. But these were people that we didn't necessarily socialize with, although, I mean, here in Pittsburgh, although we did some. And, for instance, we became very close friends with our next-door neighbors, and we now...
What was your name?
Their name is Wolf, W-U-L-F. They're two computer experts, not programmers. They both were tenured professors at Carnegie Mellon, and he now has a software business in here in Pittsburgh that he got some investment. What do you call it when people invest in a not enterprise?
No,
he got somebody people to invest in money in his in this business, and he's doing they're working very hard. It's called Tarkan Labs, and they're wonderful people. They're younger than we consider. I think they're probably young enough to be our children almost, but they're we're just very good friends, and we have subscriptions to both the Playhouse and the Pittsburgh Public Theater because we wanted to guarantee that we would get together sometimes, and this was such a good way to do it because we both enjoy theater, and so we see them several times a year, and we keep in touch. Yeah, I don't miss my house one bit, but we did have good friends in among our neighbors.
You lived quite close to Highland Park. Did you utilize the park a lot?
To a degree, there is a Highland Park Community Club, which in its way was a forerunner to some of the community organizations that we have come to know now, the Urban Coalition but that I believe that the community club was formed at the time of World War II, because they to provide some recreation for the children of the community, and it was well established when we moved there in 1953. And Jimmy became active. He was an officer in the club, and they had all kinds of there was a Christmas party every year, and they had a dance, a spring dance, and various functions. Now they have in the summertime they have for the last number of years they've had a kind of fair in Highland Park with booths. Joan, I think that you. You brought your purses there
we
one
did.
Year, did you not,
I
to sell?
I certainly did.
Made
a whole day.
And that's a lot of fun. That's similar to other kinds of community activities, mm-hmm. I think, that are offered around the city. But I have the very warm feelings about the East End, and I used to get still do get kind of annoyed with my Squirrel Hill friends, whom I love dearly, who, you know, I used to kid them. I said, you think it was the Far East End? It was very hard to get people to come if I wanted to have a meeting there. People did come to my house after a while for council meetings, but you know, way over there, and nobody seemed you know it was just off the beaten track. And you know, it's all of 10 minutes from Squirrel Hill, and public transportation is not good to get from East End to Squirrel Hill. You have to transfer, and it's a real pain in the neck. But you know, with everybody driving, it's really no distance at all. But it seems that the cars only go one way from East End. West.
While we're talking about the neighborhood, did you shop in East Liberty? Was East Liberty part of your?
Not very much.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, Jimmy was connected with downtown department stores. First Horns, when we were first married, and later Kaufman's. So as far as that kind of shopping was concerned, I went into town. And Monday night, late Monday afternoon and Monday evening was my favorite time to shop, because I would go downtown and do whatever I had to do, and Jimmy and I would have dinner together, and sometimes with Diane too, and then we would come home at 9 o'clock. That was a big Monday night. But I did my grocery shopping. I became a Stevenson, George Stevenson Company customer, because of the fact that they delivered. And
where
I, of
was
course,
that?
That was at Penn and Highland, Penn and Highland.
No,
not Penn.
It's not Penn, it's at the bridge.
Yeah, Highland Avenue. The building is still there now.
It's an art gallery.
It's an art gallery, mm-hmm. Furniture, mm-hmm. Furnishings kind of thing. And it was a wonderful market. And they delivered, and of course, I couldn't drive. Mm-hmm. So a friend told me about them and introduced me introduce myself to a man, Buzzy Kramer, who took care of me there for as long as he was there. And so that was where I did the bulk of my shopping. And then gradually I turned to more to the Giant Eagle and some of the but I did my grocery shopping almost exclusively in the East End. Now that I live in Oakland, I still go back to my familiar haunts, but I'm shopping more and more on Murray Avenue, because it's really more convenient, and I'm finding that there are all kinds of goodies that I enjoy buying. It's good to get I'm using the kosher, Prime Kosher, the kosher markets more, which I never did, and the fish market and all the specialty stores, which I enjoy.
I'd like to go back a little bit to when your children were in elementary school and high school. Did they have PTA? Were you involved? What activities were you involved in?
Well, I really was not able, certainly in the beginning. I belonged to the Fulton PTA as soon as I was able to. And I also, there was a parent-teacher, I'm trying to think what the name of it was, more than parent-teacher, at Peabody. And I belonged, but was not active. I would go, I went to meetings, and I certainly was interested in what was going on at school. But by that time, I was involved in NCJW, mm-hmm. and other kinds of community things, and I just could not be terribly active there. But there were PTAs in both schools.
Can you tell us what your very first involvement in NCJW was, and your subsequent spreading out into the community? How did you get started with? Prompted you to choose that group?
Well, Minnie Sussman, no, I'm sorry, that was later. That was great. The first thing the job I was asked to do was to take over at the membership as chairman in those days of membership. Lillian Goldsmith, Mrs. Ken Goldsmith, was the chairwoman at the time, and was pregnant and was not able to continue, and they were looking for a replacement, and they came to me. I don't remember who came to me.
Were you a member?
I was a member. I transferred my membership from, I had been active in Cleveland and was on the board of the Cleveland section. So, the road was laid open for me here, and I was delighted. I mean, I really, first of all, I was looking to, to make more friends, and I knew that councilwomen would be my kind of woman, so I was pleased to have had the way prepared. But anyhow, when they asked me to be membership chairwoman, to conduct membership, I said, how can you ask somebody who's an absolute stranger to the city? And Margaret Woodson was present, and she said, now volunteer. She said, you can do it, and I'll help you. And she said, everything is all set up, you know, the committee, you have a committee, and the plans have been made. All we need is someone to administer and to carry out the plans that have already been laid. So I took the plunge, and from then on it was easy, you know, I never learned to say no. but it was a very successful drive, as I recall. And for a number of years, I was sort of pegged in the membership department. And I think the next step was that I was asked to be vice president of membership. And Minnie Sussman and Grace Scheinman came to call on me to ask me if I would accept, you know, they were, must have been on the nominating committee, I assume. And I was very, very reluctant. I was afraid, you know, that it was too much responsibility, and they really talked me into it. And I did it, and I was membership vice president for, that was my first really major job with council. And when that term expired, our financial secretary records had gotten into a terrible muddle because we had a couple of financial secretaries who really just were not geared to the kind of detail work that is required by that office. And I can't describe to you the mess that everything was in. And I like that kind of, you know, I like detail, and I do it reasonably well. And it was something I could do at home. And Jim used to kid me. He said, "I don't mind how much work you do," he said, "but I do draw the line when you take the files to bed with you," which I did from time to time, not every night. But I enjoyed that job, and. I'm not doing too well chronologically. I can't. I can't remember. I was periodically involved in community services too. I was one of the original volunteers for Council House, mm-hmm. which is our was our pilot program for service to people coming out of mental institutions, maybe primarily. And
where was that? Which
it's about 20 years ago, I think. I don't have the exact date, but we met. Council House met once a week in the old council lounge on Forbes Avenue, Forbes Street, in the upstairs. And I think we maybe had. A good night, we had maybe 7 or 8 clients.
Met in the evening?
It met, yeah, once. It was, I think it was Monday night. And of course, the Monday night program still continues. And I remained, you know, very committed to it, and even took a tremendous interest in it when I became president. Which was in 1962, and I'm not sure about all that went on in that interim period. But I was president from 1962 to 1964, and the second year of my term, the council it was funded by a grant from the national from NIMH, National Institute of Mental Health. It was a 3-year grant, and the funds were running out, and the program had grown tremendously, and we couldn't afford, really, the section could not afford to fund it. And we just were having with all kinds of support of moral support behind us from Mayhew, the director of Mayhew, and other people in the field, we were then, and Council House, which is now Renaissance Center, was then and is now the only social rehabilitation agency of its kind in Allegheny County. There are a few services here and there, but this is the only agency that's in there. And we just had a terrible time getting funds for it. And I went to Eleanor Perlman, who was a past president of Section, had assumed the chairmanship, and her husband passed away. Mm-hmm. And she went back to school and had to go to work, so she had to resign. And I went directly from the presidency into the chairmanship of Council House, and was responsible for raising the for
nothing.
No, I don't mean not single-handedly, but as the chairwoman, it was the responsibility of the Council House committee to raise the funds to keep it going, and we eventually did. And of course, it was then it became a community agency, a state agency. That was right after the passage of the Mental Health Mental Rehabilitation Act, the State Act of 1965. I remember that date very well. When there were some state funds available and a plan for serving, and we had we fit into the provisions of the and the regulations of that act, and so we were able to get our funding. And then it was turned over, and we had we were involved in it up until just a few years ago, a couple of years ago, and I think they're still we've tried to maintain some representation on the board. There were some financial problems a year or so ago, and they had to reorganize. And that was when they changed the name, because they had to really go, I guess, kind of go out of business and begin again, in a sense. It's the same agency, it's just under a different name.
Did you continue attending board meetings?
No, I did for a long time. I would say up until maybe 5 years ago.
What is the name now?
Renaissance Center.
I wonder if you could describe a little bit, going back to the beginning of Council House, what exactly did you do at these meetings?
It was strictly a sort of a resocialization kind of thing. We just we served food, a snack, and there was entertainment. And just kind of sitting around, it was not a terribly structured program. I cannot remember the name of the woman who chaired it initially, but she was a professional. She had professional mm-hmm. training, and there were number of people who were involved in it who were professional. Who had a professional background, which I did not. I mean, I was strictly a layperson, and the only requirement really for volunteering in the program was that a sense of compassion and being able to mm-hmm. relate to people. And we used to laugh sometimes that you couldn't. Sometimes you couldn't tell the volunteers from the clients. They're not, they weren't necessarily all that different. They mm-hmm. just had problems. And our concept originally was that we would be a bridge from the hospital to the community. But we had some wonderful professional guidance. People from Western Psych and from the hospitals and other social workers who served on our professional advisory committee. The program grew and expanded tremendously. And what it was not very long before we came to understand that it was not so much, if it was a bridge, it was a bridge that went in both directions, because we were serving people who, many of whom, of course, the people who were released, from that first batch, some of whom had been in hospitals for many years and simply could not exist in the community without some kind of support system for them. And so many of our members, they never called themselves clients, they were members, and they took great pride in their membership. But many of them had a pattern of back and forth, into the community, and then having to go back to the hospital. They would neglect to take their medication, which, that there was a revolution in treating the mentally ill at that time because of the tranquilizing drugs that came into use. And of course, if they didn't keep up their medication, they would get sick again. So we began to understand, that it was not that one thing necessarily the way out of, but just a way of keeping a supporting arm under them, and I think it succeeds extremely well in that.
It is an old agency.
Well, the reorganization, as I say, was because of, I don't like to say mismanagement, but it was poor management, it was strictly from financial considerations, bills that were not paid and whatnot. It was like going, in a sense, like going through bankruptcy almost. But now there, NCJW does not have any real connection. I'm not even sure, I'm ashamed to say, whether there is anybody from NCJW that serves on that board.
Not
we have tried. You know, the mentally ill are not a big draw for volunteers. They're either not so, I don't think they're so much afraid, although there may be part, it may partly be that. They're just simply not an attractive group.
Mm-hmm.
And babies and children and even senior adults have much more emotional draw for volunteer participation.
Mm-hmm.
A council house, for all its great success, was never a big did not draw a quantity of volunteers. Quality,
yes, indeed.
Indeed, and we did. The volunteers come now from the and have for many years have come from the whole community. NCJW, from the earliest days, could not provide a sufficient number.
Did you have anything to do with the MHMR legislation that was passed?
Oh, we, NCJW certainly supported it. I was, in those days, I was not as active in public affairs and in social action as I, that's now my bailiwick, and I'm kind of the senior faculty advisor for that department. I was always interested, but not as active in it, nowhere near, mm-hmm. as I am now. And that's really my main interest today is in advocacy and
can you tell us a little bit how that started then?
I guess it really started during my presidency. Frances Krasick was my executive vice president, and she was only able to serve my first year in office because her husband became very ill and subsequently passed away. So that I really only had the benefit of her sterling support for that 1 year. But her field was more the community services and public affairs. And she, while, you know, the buck stopped at my desk, she really took responsibility for day-to-day operations in community service and public affairs, and I was membership and fundraising, and PR. You know, the other three departments were sort of under my general supervision, and we met weekly at her house.